Case number 13-1263 et al., Treasure State Resource Industry Association petitioner versus Environmental Protection Agency and Gina McCarthy, Administrator, U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Mr. Mercer for petitioner, Treasure State Resource Industry Association. Mr. McWilliams for petitioner, United States Steel Corporation. And Ms. Berman for respondents.
Morning. Good morning.
It pleases the court. I'm William Mercer on behalf of Treasure State Resource Industry Association, and with my colleague Marie Durant, we seek a judgment from this court that the rule promulgated by EPA be reversed. I'd like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal, if I may. Your Honors, this case is not about the EPA's exercise of its technical expertise and the discretion that this court typically gives that exercise. This case is about the failure of EPA to follow its own rules, guidelines, and policy statements. And by virtue of its failure of doing so at two different stages of this case, it's committed an arbitrary and capricious act that demands reversal by this court. If we look specifically to the two stages of this case, the first stage was the determination that a portion of Yellowstone County, which is largely in Billings, Montana, is now been designated as a non-attainment zone for purposes of a newly promulgated rule for SO2. That rule in 2010 led to the non-attainment decision. EPA did not follow the recommendation of the state of Montana, and the state of Montana had indicated that it was skeptical and concerned about the quality of the data that would form the basis for the opinion. EPA, in a variety of ways, did not balance that data and did not follow its policy statements and its guidelines in reaching the non-attainment decision that it imposed.
What are the policy statements and guidelines?
The policy statements and guidelines that we want to refer the court to start with the QAP, which is the quality management plan that's required in 40 CFR Part 58, subsection A21. And that's it's got a five-part component test. It says all monitoring organizations, in this case the state of Montana, must develop a quality system that is described and approved in quality management plans and quality assurance project plans to ensure that monitoring results do the following. A, meet a well-defined need, use, or purpose. B, provide.
These are very broad phrases, aren't they? It's kind of hard to find the sort of specificity that you would like us to find.
Well,
adequate quality. Meet a well-defined need, use, or purpose. Satisfy stakeholder expectations.
And D is certainly important as well, Your Honor. Comply with applicable standard specifications. Mm-hmm. And so the QAP that EPA relied upon was promulgated by Montana in 1996. It dealt with the former standard for SO2.
And they gave an explanation for that, didn't they? And do we require more of them than that?
Certainly not at the time of the original designation. There were concerns voiced about whether that data was reliable because of the calibration. And so at the time of the initial designation, we assert that no, that was not something that was balanced. Mm-hmm. And secondly, and I think also of great significance, are the various tests that are set forth in the EPA handbook. And I'd refer the court to exhibits, excerpts of record, the joint appendix, starting at J156 and going through to 160. These are the validation templates that guide right out of the EPA handbook. This is the version from December of 2008. And so, for instance, when they're talking about operational criteria on page 158, it says the reason for not meeting the criteria must be investigated, mitigated, or justified. And the burden is even higher with respect to the critical criteria table. And so in excerpts of record 295, in that joint appendix, there is this chart which sets forth ten columns there. Of those, you've got critical criteria in columns numbered 6 and 7. You have operational criteria that are in columns 2, 3, 4, and 5. This data was not assessed by EPA, even though that's demanded by this handbook at the time of the original non-attainment designation. And as you look at this table, which is very significant, was presented to the department by petitioners as part of the petition for reconsideration, The 2010 data shows that in those critical criteria columns 6 and 7, there were failures on the first 3 days where they found where there are ranges that exceed the new parts per billion standard. 4, which is an operational criteria, there's failure on every one of the days in question except the first day. And there are other failures that are represented here as well. So when we look at that data and say, your own handbook says that this quality assurance data needed to be considered and needed to either be, in the case of the critical criteria designation, needs to be excluded. In the case of the operational criteria,
when did you all raise that? This point about the 7 discrete instances of quality assurance problems, when did you all raise that? Did you raise it during the public comment period? My notes show that you all raised that in your petition for reconsideration. And now are coming back and telling EPA that you didn't consider it at the proper time when you were making the rule. Am I right or wrong about that?
You are correct, Your Honor.
Good. Because I'm not always. That's good.
So. 295 is...
Well, that makes a difference here, doesn't it?
Well...
Why doesn't it make a difference?
It doesn't make a difference because, A, the agency has an obligation pursuant to this before they're going to promulgate a new NAAQS standard where they're going to make an attainment decision.
So you're saying they messed up in the first instance. The fact that you pointed it out later shouldn't get them off the hook.
They have the primary obligation to ensure that the data that they're utilizing for a non-attainment decision is accurate and is of an adequate quality. They didn't do any of that here. And so for that reason, this rule needs to be reversed because...
Let me ask you one question. One of your arguments is I'm just calling it your retroactive argument. And I didn't quite understand that because the way the Act works is you're always going to be relying in part on old data, right? I mean, a new standard is announced. The state has a year to designate. What other data is the state going to use, at least in that period of time, if it's not old data?
The retroactivity argument, Your Honor, is grounded in the authority, in this case, is the Supreme Court's decision in Lansgraf, this Court's decision in National Mining Association,
That's talking about the legal principle of retroactivity, whether you change established vested rights. Your argument, is at a different level of generality. You're criticizing them for using data that was collected under previous standards.
Right.
What's wrong with that?
We complied with the previous standard. They now are taking our compliance under the previous standard, and they're applying it and creating a non-attainment zone, which is to our detriment. And as the Lansgraf...
But you recognize, there's not a categorical problem with using old data, right?
If there is a retroactive effect, the standard is whether the new provision attaches new legal consequences to events completed before its enactment. And we believe that
seems quite different from looking at data which has been developed before the promulgation of the new rule to determine how a particular set of facts fit under the new rule, right?
And, Your Honor, the response to that is that Congress, when it wishes to make a statute, as it has done in the new source review area, will make a statute and it retroactive at the time of the regulation effective at the time of its promulgation. They didn't do that in this section of the Clean Air Act. And so the fact that data that showed compliance is now being used for a permittee who will now be forced to be in a non-attainment zone has a retroactive effect.
Old data, though, right? Or are you saying they can't use old data?
They can't use old data to the extent that it's going to create a non-attainment zone where compliance and the party didn't have the benefit of being able to know that it needed to have a different standard or otherwise it was going to be in a non-attainment
context. Can they use it to determine an attainment zone?
As long as there isn't a retroactive effect to the detriment, then it wouldn't have
negative
effect.
So you're saying they can use it to determine attainment. Well, there are other parties in this country who would say, an attainment that's not based on a good set of data has consequences for them, whether environmental plaintiffs or something like that. So I'm trying to figure out your implications here.
Well, and so it could be used to the extent that it didn't have a retroactive effect that would be negative what it would be for some permittee in a non-attainment zone, and for unclassifiable.
But negative isn't the test that Landgraf uses, is it? I mean, negative going forward, as in you don't get, you're subject to a new regulatory scheme, is pretty commonplace. We have a lot of cases rely on old data to impose prospective regulatory processes.
And the standard in Landgraf repeated in National Mining Association is creates a new obligation, imposes a new duty, or attaches a new disability in respect to transactions or considerations already passed, and then the passage that I already referred to, whether the new provision attaches new legal consequences to events completed before its enactment. And final thought on this, and then I've got to rest.
Which new rules are applied are the actual emissions from sources after adoption of the rule, right?
And
those are the consequences fitting the Landgraf language. And I have to say, I don't see the problem.
And the problem that we're attempting to articulate is this scheme allows for an unclassifiable designation. And if there's going to be a negative consequence from compliance under the old regime that is going to be to the detriment of the permittee, it has a retroactive effect.
It's a negative consequence of compliance. It's a negative consequence of the interaction of the real world with the new standards.
All right. I think I'm out of time.
You can answer the question if you'd like. Or have you answered? No, sir.
Well, I believe that the point that I'm trying to make is that the statute allows for an unclassifiable designation. It allows for attainment. It also allows for non-attainment. To the extent that old data are being used to the detriment of the permittee, then it has a retroactive effect. The other two designations do not.
And I just have one quick question before you sit down. Back to the previous argument, do you have an example of a case where EPA relied on failures in data, maybe critical data or critical and operational data, technical failures, to say we cannot use that data, throw it away completely without, even though the weight of the evidence would have been reliable? Do you have any example where they behaved the way you think they should behave?
This Mississippi Commission case that we talked about in our Notice of Supplemental Authority gets at that. That's a case where this court said, first of all, EPA did not utilize compliance data for that decision. And this court went on to say it must be collected in compliance.
Was that state-collected compliance data, or was that the private data you're talking about that hadn't been subject to quality assurance?
I'm going to have to check that.
Okay.
I'll try to address that on rebuttal.
We'll give you some time.
Okay,
thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Douglas McWilliams with Squire Patton Boggs, and we represent today the United States Steel Corporation. I would like to reserve 60 seconds for rebuttal. In this case, we're challenging U.S. EPA's final action for the designation of a portion of Detroit, Michigan, as non-attainment for the one-hour SO2 standard.
But just to be clear, your beef with what EPA has done is the failure to designate Monroe County as part of it. That is the error that you're claiming, right?
That's correct. The definition of non-attainment includes all areas contributing to non-attainment. So to the extent there are areas of Monroe County that are contributing to non-attainment in Wayne County in the Detroit, Michigan area, that too has to be included within the boundary.
Why isn't the EPA's finality argument fatal to your claim there? They say we're still looking at Monroe County. They're uncertainties, perhaps they want to get the data right to make sure everyone's content. So they have made no decision one way or the other on Monroe County.
Under Section 107D, EPA has three options. They can designate an area non-attainment, they can designate an area unclassifiable, or they can designate an area attainment. The definition of non-attainment includes any area contributing to non-attainment.
But there's nothing in the law that tells you where that boundary needs to be drawn. It's just that Monroe County has to be non-attainment at some point in time, but it doesn't tell us where the boundary needs to be drawn, does it? Is there any authority for that?
I would say the statutory scheme dictates that the contributing sources define the boundary, that you can't actually
What if EPA is uncertain as to a particular area adjacent to an area that it thinks is clear? What exactly is the objection to it saying we're going to wait to reach a final conclusion on this adjacent area until we know better? But we'll go ahead with the designation of the area that we're confident belongs as non-attainment.
The area non-attainment, the boundaries of that area must include those contributing to the non-attainment area.
Yes,
the reason
that statute, but they're uncertain as to a particular adjacent area.
If there's an insufficient basis for making the designation for the non-attainment area, then the appropriate classification under 107D is unclassified.
Well, no, would you have the same position if they were to decide that the Monroe plant belongs in a different non-attainment area? Mm-hmm.
A determination that the Monroe plant
belongs in a neighboring one. The background presumption is that they use county lines to decide attainment areas. Not written in stone, but that's a background presumption. So if they were trying to figure out whether Monroe County should be its own non-attainment area, and where, let's say they put the Monroe plant in a Monroe County non-attainment area, would you have the same objection you have now?
We would, because the way you draw the boundary for non-attainment determines which sources have to contribute to bringing that area into attainment. The statutory scheme.
Your argument basically is you want to share the burden here, right?
Precisely.
Right.
Those contributing
but
to the burden.
What is the authority that says that the non-attainment that Monroe County needs to be part of the same map that's drawn here? Why can't there be two separate non-attainment counties? My question is a different one than what Judge Williams is asking. I think he's got a question too about finality. But I want to know where your authority is that says that the Monroe County plant needs to be part of the same non-attainment area here.
The authority is the definition of non-attainment.
Do you have examples of instances, case law or anything where that's required?
In the Catawba case, this court determined that the appropriate way to draw non-attainment boundaries was to include all areas contributing to non-attainment.
But to Judge Millett's question about why can't you have a separate non-attainment area for Monroe County? That may very well happen.
Yeah, what if it's contributing a lot more to Monroe County?
Yeah.
Well, but the boundaries, because they define the sources that have to reduce emissions in order to satisfy attainment, if you leave out a source,
you don't have to include everything. If a little whiff is coming over from one plant, but it's really contributing substantially to another county, surely you wouldn't say that, oh no, because some whiffs come over now and then, that has to be in this area.
This is certainly not a situation where it's a whiff.
I'm trying to test your analysis here. It's not that everything that potentially contributes in any amount has to be within the attainment area, does it?
That's correct. This court has determined that a significant contribution is an appropriate way for EPA to determine that contribution. Here we have the Monroe Coal-Fired Power
Plant. We have the default rule of counties, and so the county is clearly in non-attainment. You don't dispute that. And if they're just not sure whether the Monroe plant is a significant source or a less than significant source for your county, and they want to look at what it's doing in another county, your position is they're paralyzed, they can't move until they can't designate what is clearly a non-attainment area undisputed by you until they actually figure out everything that's outside and put it in its own place?
At least they have to follow their own methodology for determining if a source is a significant contributing source. Here, the methodology they determine was to evaluate the total emissions and divide it by the distance to the monitor.
What I see is the problem, so maybe you can address my misunderstanding. It seems to me you've got two problems. If you're right that the Monroe County plant has to be part of the same non-attainment area, then I think you run into the finality problem that Judge Williams has raised. They haven't finished deciding that. If, on the other hand, it doesn't need to be part of the same area, well, then you do have a finality. The issue is final. They've finally drawn the boundary, but it doesn't need to include the Monroe Power Plant if it's going to be part of another non-attainment area.
To address Judge Williams' finality issue, we have an opportunity to designate the entire area unclassifiable because there's an insufficient basis to draw boundaries that include all contributing sources. Mm-hmm. The 118,000 tons that Monroe emitted, when divided by the distance from the Southwest High School monitor, made it the third most significant source in the area.
Is that before or after the 2009 scrubbers?
That's after the 2000. No, that's, I'm sorry, before the 2009 scrubbers. But even after the 2009 scrubbers, when the emissions were dropped to 47,000 tons, when you divide that by the same distance, they are the fourth most significant source contributing to the Detroit non-attainment area.
Correct me if I'm wrong, geographically, you know, U.S. Steel, they're right near this high school monitor.
Correct.
And you've got Monroe sort of down here, and that between the two of them is an area called Allen Park, which is actually an attainment.
That's true. There's an Allen Park monitor.
And so your boundary... Is your boundary going to skirt around Allen Park, or are you actually saying that whole area has to come in, even though there's this big area between Monroe and this monitor where the air is an attainment, so whatever's coming over from Monroe County isn't bothering the air in between?
The meteorology, which is one of the elements mm-hmm. that's to be considered in determining the non-attainment area, indicates that the emissions from Monroe County, with its very high stacks, moves towards the Detroit River, up the river, and impacts the Southwest High School monitor, even though the impact on the Allen County monitor mm-hmm. is still an attainment.
What your area even is supposed to look like? Is it sort of gerrymandered around the Allen Park County? So we're skipping over one county altogether, and we're going to have two counties separated by another county that are a single non-attainment area?
No, Monroe is adjacent to the Wayne County area. Mm-hmm. The boundary between the Wayne County non-attainment area and Monroe does not have any independent area.
Is Allen Park not between the two of them?
It is not. They share mm-hmm. a jurisdictional boundary. Mm-hmm. So the air emissions, according to the meteorology and the modeling that we provided in our petition for reconsideration, indicates that those emissions do, in fact, head up the Detroit River and significantly impact the Southwest High School monitor.
And then, I'm sorry, are you done?
I was just going to conclude, unless you have another question.
Well, I actually wanted to back up and talk about standing.
Sure.
What I'm trying to figure out is how would U.S. Steel, the regulatory impact on U.S. Steel be changed if Monroe County were included in the non-attainment area?
If the area that includes the Monroe coal-fired power plant is included in the non-attainment boundary, Monroe's coal-fired power plant would be part of the solution. It would include emission reductions towards the attainment obligations of those sources within the non-attainment.
It may well have its own regulatory burdens and have to be part of the solution. How will U.S. Steel be impacted? Is it that your point, you'll have less regulation because you're right next to the monitor, or is it a competitive advantage problem?
No, the implications for the reasonably available control measures is that you reduce emissions to the extent necessary to bring the area into attainment. According to the monitor data right now, it's clear that the Monroe power plant's emission reductions have already satisfied the non-attainment problem because the Detroit area is currently in attainment for the SO2 standard. Because of the way the Michigan State Implementation Plan is structured, you start with the larger sources and gradually move to smaller and smaller sources until you've solved the problem. Well, if you start with the largest source here, it's Monroe.
Well, they're not going to start with just one. U.S. Steel is also a very large source and would be regulated, I think. Right? You're not telling us that if Monroe plant were in, U.S. Steel wouldn't be regulated at all?
It would be within the realm of the statutory scheme for all of the emission reductions.
In your experience in this area, what are the chances that if the non-attainment area you want were drawn, U.S. Steel would not be regulated at all?
I think it's the chances are low that it, that U.S. Steel would not be regulated at all.
But
it could be regulated differently, which is all we need in order to have standing.
You see, if I understand what you're saying, and I'll certainly ask the EPA representative this, RACT, a wonderful acronym, depends simply on achieving attainment. I shouldn't say simply, but depends on achieving attainment, so that once attainment is achieved, no further reductions are to be ordered or need be ordered in any event. Is that correct?
The definition of reasonably available control technology is in part affected by what's necessary to bring the area into attainment.
Yeah.
So yes, you can amend RACT.
100 units have to be reduced and some new source is brought into the picture and is reducing them by 50, that presumably makes it easier for the other sources.
Correct.
Yeah.
But you've already got, I guess I have two questions from that. One, Michigan can regulate Monroe, you can regulate plants that are outside the non-attainment area as contributing sources. Even if, they don't have to be in the non-attainment area to be regulated by Michigan, correct?
That's correct. But
is the ability to regulate different? I'm just trying to figure out why we couldn't all be in the exact same place.
The non-attainment area defines who's required to reduce emissions. The fact that the state has the discretion to also include reductions for Monroe is a discretionary fix to a mandatory problem or flaw in this case.
And Michigan has already adopted a final rule. Is that
they
my
proposed
that's my
the SIP. It's not a final
it's
rule.
Not
final.
Yet. Oh, it's already proposed. It's
but
not.
It's been
not finalized.
Proposed.
When is it going to be finalized?
After the public comment period at some point in the next year.
And are you advocating for the Michigan authorities that the power plant be brought in as a source of the solution to the Wayne County issue?
We will certainly be commenting on the state implementation plan with regards to its impact on the U.S. Steel Corporation facilities, and to the extent they have that authority, we would encourage the state to consider the voluntary emission reductions necessary to address Monroe's issues.
But the proposed SIP, does it propose regulating Monroe at all?
It does not. So we're asking this court, in conclusion, to vacate the non-attainment designation for Wayne County. Based on the record, excluding Monroe, the Monroe Power Plant was arbitrary and capricious. We also ask that, based on this record, that this court designate the area unclassifiable until EPA can come up with a reasoned determination for the contributing sources to the Wayne County non-attainment problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Amanda Berman. I'm here representing the United States EPA. At council table with me is Mike Thrift from EPA's Office of General Counsel. Before delving into the jurisdictional and merits issues presented here today, I'd like to put these challenges in a little bit of context. In this rule, EPA designated 29 areas as non-attainment in regard to the 2010 National Ambient Air Quality Standard for Sulfur Dioxide, a pollutant with localized impact linked to serious respiratory issues. Petitioners challenged only two of those 29 designations, and the non-attainment status of one of those areas is not really contested here. Rather, the challenge is really to the non-designation of a neighboring county. I think this reflects something important about this rule, that it addressed areas that, from EPA's perspective, were relatively easy calls, where the monitoring data available to the agency clearly showed that those areas exceeded the standard during the 2009 to 2011 period.
I'm not sure that I followed the argument at all. But if let's assume the record shows that EPA got it right, absolutely right, in 27 out of 29 cases, does that really shed any light on the other two?
No, I see what you're saying, Judge Williams. All I'm trying to say is that as a backdrop, from EPA's perspective, I want the court to know that these are areas where we think the monitoring data is very clear, and I'll go into the record specific areas issues that show that. Petitioner Treasure State tries to undermine the Billings area designation by nitpicking EPA's analysis of the relevant data. But its analysis of that data...
I mean, let's be fair. It's not nitpicking. They're talking about some things that I think you call them critical criteria that weren't met, and your own rules or handbooks talk about critical criteria. You know, if you violate the critical criteria, that's very consequential, and you shouldn't rely on the data. Am I understanding that, how that operates, what you
said? I think so, but I think in that case we have to look at the arguments that were actually made and when they were made here. In their comments on the rule, Petitioner Treasure State made the same sort of very general allegations of operational failures, problematic data, that it made in its opening brief here. And EPA did respond to those in its response to comments. It's only in the reconsideration petition that this sort of laundry list of alleged discrepancy between the monitoring regulations and the handbook and the operation of this monitor was identified.
Let's just figure out what's going on here. I mean, you all know your own handbook. Are there past instances when you've had violations of critical criteria that the EPA has nonetheless relied in part on that data along with other information and made a weight of evidence determination?
EPA has always used this weight of the evidence approach.
Even when there's violations of critical criteria?
Well, I have to quarrel with the idea that there's necessarily violations of critical criteria here. The chart they pointed you to is something
that... Can I just back up and get your answer to the question first?
Sorry.
And then I'm happy to hear the details about it. Is there an instance in which there have been violations of critical criteria, but nonetheless the weight of the evidence, total evidence, warranted use of that data amongst other data to make a non-attainment decision? Or do we have to accept there was no violation of critical criteria for you to
win? I don't think you have to accept that there was absolutely no mm-hmm. violation of critical criteria. What EPA is saying here is that it's always followed this idea that what we're looking for is overall compliance. And I mean, in the mission.
So where is an example where there was critical criteria violations and yet weight of the evidence prevailed?
I can't identify a case where something was called a critical criteria violation. Okay. But I think this is a bit of a red herring because this chart that they've pointed you to is something that was given to the agency after, it's not even part of their reconsideration petition. It was given to the agency during discussions afterwards. And in denying reconsideration, and I'd point the court to the record at Joint Appendix page 301, EPA walks through and very specifically responds to each of these laundry list of alleged discrepancies. You know, one that they've pointed to a couple times is the fact that performance checks on the monitor in question were on one or two occasions not performed every 14 days as they're supposed to be, but every 21 days. Now, EPA explained in response that, in fact, in many instances, those checks were performed more frequently than required. But in any event, on the one time they identify where there's a 21-day window, there are the criteria measured on either side and the two checks on either side showed that the monitor was working fine during that period. These performance checks, the point is to make sure that the monitor is functioning. EPA has no reason to doubt that it was functioning during that period. So, you know, and I would encourage the court to really look at its pages 301 through next four or five pages. EPA very specifically responds to those assertions. But again, those weren't raised in comments on the rule with that sort of specificity.
Were any of these critical criteria?
Sorry?
Were any of these critical criteria?
I'm not really as familiar with what the line they're drawing between what they call critical and non-critical. From EPA's perspective, the things in the regulations, I think those might be called critical because they're regulatory, and EPA's explained that there's a different level of scrutiny applied to discrepancies with the regs versus discrepancies with the handbook, which is just guidance. So maybe that's where that line is being drawn. But in any event, EPA has addressed both types of discrepancies in responding to these issues on reconsideration, and I think it did so very comprehensively.
Part of your argument is it doesn't matter if you used weight of evidence before because that was the governing standard when you came in to do this anyhow?
Yes, that standard was put in place in 2013 before comments were due on the proposed rule and before finalization of the rule in question. So if they had an issue with that standard, it should have been raised then.
From EPA's perspective, also was that that really wasn't a new standard. It was just
from EPA's perspective, it's a codification of a common sense approach. EPA's regulations, their monitoring regulations, I mean, they run many, many pages in the Federal Register. They're very comprehensive and for good reason. But EPA has always taken the approach that one mischeck, one discrepancy, is not reason to toss out the data. I mean, EPA would never have enough data to make any decision if it had to do that. But I'd like to return to the arguments that Treasure State actually made both in its comments and its opening brief here, which are broader arguments. First, that the 1997 Quality Assurance Plan is just too old. Second, that the monitor wasn't designed for this particular standard. Third, that the fact that it was recalibrated in 2010 shows that it's not up to the task of generating data for this particular NAAQS before that. And fourth, we were just discussing this laundry list of discrepancies. But regarding those first three things, while EPA agrees that the Montana Quality Assurance Plan was due for a revision, and in fact it has now been revised, that's not a mandatory requirement. And plans don't lapse into disapproval if a state doesn't meet that every five-year guidance. And EPA's regulations don't require that a monitor be specifically designed for a particular NAAQS set at a particular level. The regulatory requirement that's applicable here is that the monitor has to produce adequate quality data. That's in 40 CFR Part 58, Appendix A, Section 2.1b. The Coburn Road Monitor meets that relatively low bar. It's audited regularly, as EPA explained in responding to comments, at levels that are low enough to show that it's up to the task of recording data for a 75 parts per billion standard. And the fact that it was recalibrated in 2010 doesn't undermine the validity of data recorded before that. If I tune my viola between pieces during a concert, that doesn't mean that the sound I was creating before was horribly off-key. I'm just trying to ensure the continued quality of the sound I'm creating. Now, if we have a presumption to the contrary for emissions monitors, that would create a really perverse incentive for states that might want to have a particular year of data, like the 2010 Coburn Road data, taken off the books. And the facts don't warrant that presumption here. Rather, the monitor was audited before and after the recalibration to ensure that it was able to measure data at this standard. So collectively, we don't think Treasure State's arguments amount to any more of the sum of their parts, which is zero. They've not only failed to identify any fatal flaw in the data from the Coburn Road Monitor, they failed to articulate any real substantive issue with that data at all, except that the 2010 data was too high and so should be discarded as outlying. But the state certified that data. Montana certified that data for EPA's use. And so this sort of cherry picking, we think, is just not a rational approach to the designations process, and it's certainly not an approach that we think EPA should be compelled to take. I'd like to finally, on the Montana side, just address the retroactivity issue that this court asked some questions about. I think this court's case law and the Supreme Court's case law is clear that we don't have a retroactivity issue here. In Landgraf, the Supreme Court explained that, you know, relying on antecedent facts is not retroactivity. Rather, as this court's explained, for example, in the National Petrochemicals and Refiners Association case, the question is whether new sanctions are being imposed on old conduct. Old conduct isn't being sanctioned here. We're just using data that was gathered starting before the new
acts. Does it have to be sanctions, or are new legal consequences sufficient?
This court has used the term sanctions, so I think it has to
be. Landgraf didn't use that language. Landgraf used broader language. And I think I don't think all our cases have been consistent in limiting it to sanctions.
Well, but even so, we're not imposing legal consequences on pre-NAAQS conduct.
Well,
we're
imposing,
just using the data.
It's essentially
gathered.
Like they're put on probation now based on what happened before. Now, all right, we look back at what you did, lots of bad air. And so now you're going to have to change your conduct, and you're going to have to be subject to all these new regulatory burdens based on what you did 3 years ago. And so why isn't that a retroactivity problem? This isn't we're affecting your benefits prospectively. We're actually, as they describe it, being subjected to regulatory burdens that other folks are not based on past conduct.
Well, but I think if that's retroactivity, that would always be true in regard to this sort of designations process, because the data you're relying on to make a designation necessarily has to predate the designation.
Well, maybe the problem here, though, this is the first time you used 3 years rather than 1 year for sulfur dioxide. Is that correct?
Yes, the standard was changed from annual average to 3 year average.
So is there a problem with that particular overlay that they didn't have notice about 3 years, the consequences of at any given time, 3 years of data can be used to impose regulatory burdens on us. So should there at least have been notice of that before you started imposing regulatory burdens?
But they knew that the Coburn Road Monitor was up and it was measuring sulfur dioxide concentrations in regard to the standards that were in place at the time. So I think they do have notice. It's not a newly created regime. It's just an adjustment of the standard, and we're using the data that we have, which necessarily is going to predate the new standard to some degree.
Suppose in developing a SIP, Montana shows that, for example, the 2010 data that are problematic, that was the result of some extraordinary event never likely to be repeated. Would those who create the SIP bear that in mind in deciding on what cutbacks are necessary?
Well, it is up to the state to decide what has to happen to bring the area into attainment. So I think they could.
With EPA looking
with the EPA's approval at the end of the day. Your Honor, I would note that, Montana did make that kind of argument in its amicus brief here. It tries to link the 2010 data to some control testing that had to be done at an ExxonMobil refinery in the area. But EPA looked at that and explained that the exceedances we see in 2010 don't line up with the dates of the testing.
Yeah, that was sort of a scientific analytical one. It wasn't responding to this notice point about the use of 3 years of data. And you yourselves have said there are severe consequences to these detainment decisions, so severe consequences attach. And so why isn't that that feels at least a little bit different to me from some of our other cases where backwards-looking data has affected the flow of benefits into somebody going forward.
I just don't think it meets that high standard set in Landgraf, where it's...
What's the high standard in Landgraf?
Well, rather, it doesn't meet... I think it clearly falls in this category of relying on antecedent facts to make a designation that applies going forward.
I mean, at some level, there's got to be a line between... what are the consequences from mm-hmm. the past facts, right? If past facts are imposing a sentence, criminal sentence, that clearly is out. That's retroactive. Is it only penalties or sanctions, or can it be such a distinct and heavy regulatory burden? Could that ever have sufficient effect to trigger retroactivity concerns?
Could it ever? I mean, possibly, but I think we have to look what is being sanctioned here. It's not the past conduct. What are the consequences attaching to? Mm-hmm. They're not attaching to the past conduct.
But you say it's true if, but only if, EPA does make an adjustment of the sort that I suggested, namely allowing Montana to explain away high figures in a particular test as not going forward, and therefore not requiring any changes.
But, Your Honor, the state certified the 2010 data for EPA's use, and I think that is an important fact here.
But I don't think that gets at what Judge Blood is asking.
Well, I'd point, Your Honor, to the practical consequences then. Under the statutory scheme, states have only 1 year to submit proposed designations after a new NAAQS is put in place. Even if EPA had kept the NAAQS at an annual averaging, states wouldn't be able to meet that congressional requirement because, in fact, you need more than 1 year to get 1 year of data. Certification doesn't happen until May of the following year. So EPA would have to wait for an entire new, or the state would have to wait for an entire new calendar year of data for that data to be certified. So you couldn't meet the scheme that Congress has set out here.
I think if you
took this approach that you can't use any data that predates the
NAAQS. I think I'm trying to make a different point, and that is simply with respect to the breadth of the time period that you're looking backwards on. When that was brand new, that hadn't happened before, and no notice was given, and pretty significant regulatory burdens follow from reliance on that data. Do you have to one time have notice? We're going to start doing 3 years back. So for a couple of years, you'll do the 1 year, and then X year, we're going to start doing 3 years back. Was there a need for notice in that setting?
I don't think so, Your Honor. EPA followed the procedure here in that it proposed a rule. It proposed this change of the NAAQS. Everyone had an opportunity to comment on that and challenge it. And then moving after that, it went through the proposal process for the particular designation. So I think everybody had adequate notice here. I see my time is actually up.
No, keep going. Speak to Michigan, please.
Yes, okay. So I do think we have both a standing and a finality issue here. U.S. Steel hasn't shown Article III standing because there's this disconnect between the claim that it's making, the conduct it complains of, which specifically here is that EPA should have designated the Monroe County area of non-attainment in addition to Wayne County, and the harm U.S. Steel fears, which is increased regulatory burden.
Well, why isn't their point perfectly logical? It's either, imagine that there were only two potential sources. I know there were others in the area, but it was U.S. Steel and potentially Monroe Power. All right? And if they said, so now we have to carry the regulatory burden alone. We alone must change our operations to get this air level into attainment. And if you had included the Monroe plant, we'd share the burden. It would be 50% or some percentage based on some allocation. Why isn't that the difference between 100% and the shared percentage injury?
Because there's not necessarily a difference here. The state is not bound by the boundaries
of the
non-attainment
area. Wouldn't that be necessary? Is there a substantial risk of a difference? Is there a substantial prospect of a difference?
I don't think we can even say that, and I would remind the court that under its recent decision in the Swanson manufacturing case, this burden of showing each of these elements is very much on petitioners. But I don't think they've met the burden here because, you know, it's still, we're in a double speculation land right now. Because not only is it speculative that the state's going to impose any particular burdens on U.S. Steel, but it's doubly speculative that the state's going to do that and not impose any burdens on the Monroe plant.
Well, I think this use of the word speculative is way overused in standing arguments. It seems to be used any time we think we don't have certainty and we have to make predictions. And I don't think that's what speculative means in standing cases. I mean, you've been doing presumably this for some time. You're an expert in this area. What are the chances that U.S. Steel is going to be subject to regulatory burdens once they're within the attainment area? And is that different from the chances that Monroe Power is going to be in it?
You know, I honestly can't answer those questions because I'm not the state regulator. It's up to them. Is there a good chance that they're going to be...
heavily on the state regulator, and I noticed that what to me was a critical sentence at page 40 of your brief speaks only of the state to meet that requirement, attainment. The state is authorized to impose emission reduction requirements on all facilities that contributing to non-attainment. But then you also say, the EPA in its rules says there's no legal basis for states to credit emissions reductions from sources outside the non-attainment area for satisfying rock roof requirements. So that seems to, I don't know, that makes it sound as if anything Michigan does by way of tamping down emissions in Monroe County isn't going to count in the EPA assessment of what Michigan is doing.
Michigan's obligation is to submit a plan that brings the area into attainment. And in doing that, EPA has spelled out in guidance that Michigan can impose obligations on any plant it thinks is seriously contributing to the problem.
What is the meaning of that rock roof sentence that I read to you? Because it sounds as if, state can do something, that's nice, but it can't. There's no legal basis to credit emissions reductions from that.
Well, I think that's simply saying that you actually have to achieve non-attainment in the area in question. You can't say, but we've reduced some emissions over there.
Well, that's a funny way of wording it.
I agree.
It seems to draw a bright line between in the area and out of the area. I have to say, a lunatic scheme. I mean, your sentence here seems so utterly in accord with common sense that I thought I read it broadly to encompass what EPA was doing, but close-checking, it turns out that's not so clear.
Well, Your Honor, I think we need to look to what EPA has said in its guidance, and that is that the state can impose burdens on the other party. But even if we step past the speculative...
Of course the state can impose burdens. I mean, EPA has no objection to states imposing burdens. The question is whether they count, and the rule that I read you says it doesn't count, at least for rock roof purposes.
The statutory requirement is that they submit a plan that gets the state into attainment. And that's the basis on which EPA has to approve or disapprove a plan. So I think that's the critical question. And
Have you ever approved a plan in which the state only regulated sources outside the non-attainment area?
I don't know of an instance in which it has done that.
I can't imagine if they came back and said, you know what, we actually really think Monroe's the suspect here. We're regulating the dickens out of them, and we're not regulating anybody within the actual non-attainment area, that EPA would let that plan through. Can you?
Well, I think EPA would have to take a hard look at the data.
Yeah,
and to be honest, we know
look.
From what we've seen from Montana, that's not the case. In mm-hmm. fact, what Montana is seeing is consistent
Michigan.
With what EPA saw. Michigan mm-hmm. is seeing is consistent with what EPA saw in that it's really the U.S. steel plant, which is 2 kilometers from the violating monitor, has very significant emissions. You know, we do believe that, you know, there's, if we want to turn to the merits here, I mean, I think EPA is on very solid ground when it says that a facility
I know, but we're talking about whether they have an injury here.
Yes.
Whether they're injured by this designation.
Well, as I said, we don't have to use the word speculative, but the requirement is that the injury has to be concrete, imminent, particularized. I don't think they've met that burden here.
Why doesn't the proposed rule give us, from Michigan's proposed rule, give us pretty good evidence that there's an impact on them?
Well, it is still proposed, and we don't know what the final rule will look like.
Is that not enough?
But even moving past the injury, I point to causation here. It's really, this is a unique case because we really do have this disconnect between the conduct complained of, and that's the phrase from the Swanson manufacturing case. And here the conduct complained of is the non-designation of neighboring Monroe County and the injury in question. So even if we accept that, you know, their claimed injury increased regulatory burdens, it's not linked to what they complain of because they don't dispute that they're in a non-attainment area. If, as they seem to suggest, this court were to order EPA to go back and classify neighboring Monroe County as either attainment or unclassifiable, they'd still be in a non-attainment area. They'd still face the burdens
that come
along with that.
That's why I thought you might say more redress is a problem.
Well, we think redress is a problem also because we think the only logical redress here, if the court agreed with them on the merits, would be to remand to EPA to consider, you know, the designation for Monroe County. Nobody disputes that Wayne County is non-attainment. I don't see how there could be vacature of the Wayne County designation here. So we do think that there are both causation and redressability issues as well in regard to the injury issue.
I mean, if you accept the proposition that designation as non-attainment substantially increases the probability that sources within that area will be subject to mandates, it seems to me that, at least conceptually, the causation and redressability are quite clear.
Redressability is only clear if you accept their assertion that the redress here would be vacature, and I just don't think that's
I'm assuming a remand telling EPA to get cracking on Monroe County.
But in that case, Your Honor, Wayne County would still be designated as non-attainment, and U.S. Steel would still then, you know, allegations related to that.
It would have a better prospect of milder regulations.
Is that true? I mean, you could go back and say, fine, we told us to look out of the gun, Monroe County, that's a non-attainment area too. And that wouldn't affect U.S. Steel in any way, would it?
No. I mean, the idea that then U.S. Steel is going to have a lighter burden, I mean, I think that is pure speculation, Your Honor. Sorry, I'm overusing the word.
No, let me work there.
I thought in answer to 2 earlier questions, you accepted the proposition that EPA, in effect, the states could do what they like, but EPA, in effect, gave priority to reductions in emissions at sources within the area. And I think U.S. Steel is asking for an enlarged area, includes Wayne County and Monroe, at least the power plant. Why wouldn't expansion of the Wayne County area to include the power plant have a significant probability of lesser regulatory burden on U.S. Steel?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it's not necessarily, expansion is not really the right way to look at it. It's the these are separate areas, and the question is, does EPA have to go back and designate Monroe County as either attainment, non-attainment, or unclassifiable?
Doesn't EPA have the capacity to expand a previous designated area?
It's expanded only in the sense that once you put two non-attainment areas right next to each other, sharing a boundary, we tend to refer to them as one non-attainment. But it's really,
okay,
it's looking at each area and saying, is this area either non-attainment or does it contribute to non-attainment in a nearby area? And it's answering that question specifically for a certain area. Here it would be for the Monroe area. So I don't think expansion is the right way to think of it. But again, the critical point from our perspective is that Wayne County is still going to be non-attainment, and the burdens associated with that are still going to be faced by U.S. Steel here.
I certainly thought you conceded in response to Judge Millett's questions that there's at least a probability, you can't measure, of lesser burdens. Once you have another big polluter brought in as a source to be controlled.
Your Honor, no, I didn't mean to concede that. I think if I was conceding something, I would concede maybe the fact that because there is a major source in a non-attainment area, these folks will face burdens. I wouldn't really dispute that. I think the idea that they're going to have lesser burdens if we go back and designate Monroe County as non-attainment, I think that is speculation at this point.
Yeah, I thought you had conceded that if they were in the same area, then there may be some sharing of the burdens, presumably. But given that the default rule is county lines, then the chance that they would end, if you went back to the drawing table, the chances are that they'd be two separate non-attainment areas anyhow.
Well, if we went back to the drawing table, we'd be looking at designating Monroe County.
But you also said that if you did designate Monroe County, then once you had these two adjacent counties designated, you would de facto treat them as one.
I wasn't saying we would de facto. I'm saying that there is this tendency when you have several together, we refer to it broadly as the Detroit non-attainment area. But each area's obligations are based on its particular designation.
And so measurements to decide, so imagine we're in a world where you have Wayne County non-attainment area and Monroe County non-attainment area right next to each other, and everybody back in the office just generally refers to that big old area, non-attainment area. But when you're testing going forward to see if they've come into attainment, is it still going to be individualized county testing, or is it going to be a macro testing? That seems important.
I honestly can't answer that question. In terms of how the geography works here, I did want to point the court to something. And that's at page 674 of the Joint Appendix, where we have a map of these two areas showing the relationship between Wayne and Monroe County. And this also relates to the point U.S. Steel is trying to make, that the fact that we've got these intervening monitors not registering exceedances somehow should be disregarded. If you see up in Wayne County, which is in green, we've got the little red diamond, and that's the violating monitor. Now, U.S. Steel's plant is one of the sort of cream-colored dots right by that. Now, Monroe County, as you see, is well below that, and the plant in question is the dot in Monroe County. So, I mean, I think, you know, the conclusion that EPA has drawn here on the merits is a really logical one.
I think it's going to be really important for purposes of the standing inquiry to know how, once you have two adjacent counties as non-attainment areas, how is attainment measured? Is it still done county by county, or is it collective? Because if it's collective, then we're going to be back in the 100% versus 50%, you know, shared burden scenario. But if they remain, Wayne County's got to do its thing and Monroe County's got to have its own compliance, then U.S. Steel's no better off.
Well, Your Honor, it's a really tough question to answer, because I think that depends on the reasons that if EPA were to find that Monroe County were non-attainment, it would be the reasons. Is it because Monroe County itself is non-attainment, in which case the focus would be on, it, you know, can the state get Monroe County into attainment? But if Monroe County is designated non-attainment because it is contributing to Wayne County, then yes, the measuring would ultimately be a collective one of have these counties collectively brought attainment at the monitoring site in Wayne County. But you know, we can't answer these questions now because we just don't have the necessary information, and the state hasn't gone through the process.
What more information do you need about the Monroe plant?
Well, we don't think we need more information to reach the conclusion that the agency reached here, which is that the monitoring data before it doesn't show that it's nearby and contributing, as the agency has interpreted those very ambiguous statutory terms. It's 54 kilometers away from the violating monitor, and it's a local pollutant.
I thought in the Mississippi Commission case, correct me if I'm wrong, I thought there you defined nearby as neighboring counties in a metropolitan area.
Well, I would point out that...
Is that right?
Honestly, I'm not sure, but it doesn't matter, Your Honor, and the reason is that's a different pollutant, I believe, ozone. Ozone travels. Sulfur dioxide is localized. So here, 54 kilometers away is a very significant distance, whereas when you're talking about ozone, it's not necessarily as significant a difference.
Okay, so nearby has a...
Well, but there's no
chemical-specific meaning?
There's no fixed number, Your Honor, if that's what you're looking for. But what all we're saying here is that it's reasonable for EPA to say, look, we've got some sources really close to the violating monitor, including USDA, with very significant emissions. Yes, we have another source that's 54 kilometers away that does have significant emissions, but the data doesn't show us that those emissions are getting to the violating monitor. It's far away, and we've got this intervening Allen Park monitor where there's no violation. And EPA's, as I think EPA explained in responding to comments,
how do you respond to your opponent's point that the meteorological conditions explain why Allen Park is...
I don't think there's any evidence in the record that supports that assertion, that the wind is traveling in this sort of L-shaped pattern that's neatly evading the Allen Park and other non-violating monitor as it goes up the river. EPA, to the contrary, noted that the wind is variable in this area. It goes in all directions.
EPA is in violation of a consent decree on the timing of its designation of at least some non-attainment areas.
It's not in violation of a consent decree, Your Honor. Rather, there was a consent decree that was recently entered into between EPA and various parties to set a schedule for designating the remaining areas because EPA had not met the three-year statutory deadline.
And what's the schedule for, where does Monroe County fit on that schedule?
Next summer, July 2016.
Okay. And the procedure is such that U.S. Steel is able to actively participate in that to show, try to convince EPA that the power plant in Monroe County is materially responsible for the non-attainment in Wayne County.
Absolutely. As here, the designations will be proposed. All stakeholders can comment, submit data. EPA will be looking not just necessarily at monitoring them, but monitoring plus modeling data. That's when EPA believes it'll have the data it needs to reach a final conclusion and designate that area. So we don't think, the non-designation can be considered a final agency action here. I'm well over my time, so unless this court has other questions, I will sit down.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll give you back 4 minutes for rebuttal. I'm sorry. Excuse me.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, are you dividing rebuttal?
I'm sorry.
Are you going to divide rebuttal or? Okay, let's do two and two then.
Judge Millett, you ask about any sort of case that would show nullification by EPA of state data, and I'd refer you, it's not a judicial case, I'd refer you to Joint Appendix 522, which shows how they nullified data in Iowa as part of the consideration of what to do with a determination under this rule there.
Yeah, my question, though, is whether they had done that even though the weight of the evidence would have supported reliance on the data.
I'm sure
there's plenty of times they've invalidated data all over the place.
In this case, they invalid data could not be validated using the standard procedure found in Appendix T because a substantial amount of data had been flagged from 2008, 9, and 10. The government noted that seemed to suggest that the burden shifted to the parties to raise every conceivable issue up front at the time of its initial public comment. And as we cited, page 10 of our reply, EPA retains a duty to examine key assumptions as part of its affirmative burden, and therefore must justify the assumption even if no one objects to it during the public comment period. That's from Appalachian Power, 135 F3rd 791. I also would like to go back to questions about the QAP and the significance of the QAP. Joint Appendix 175 sets forth the Montana QAP that was in place at the time. We need to start with the language on 165A, all data shall be traceable to a primary standard, and then the objective, which is set forth on the next page, 6.22. And then back to the language that you and I talked about, Judge Griffith, 2.1B, the government wants to talk about how that needs to be adequate quality, but the key language that they're leaving out is, provide data of adequate quality for the intended monitoring objectives. And so these monitoring objectives on 165 and 166 were not applicable given the new standard. They were using the old standard, and the data, therefore, didn't comply with the
requirement. Isn't that a very arbitrarily narrow reading of the objective?
Well, Your Honor, you've got very clear, all data shall, mandatory language, shall be traceable to a primary standard, and then the specifics here, and the fact that they were collecting data throughout all of 2009 and through August of 2010 that was not calibrated to the new standard. They were still using the standard that had been in place since the QAP was implemented in 96. So the viability of that data is in great question, and again, was not weighed by the agency.
Intuitively seems to me for that to be meaningful. You've got to show that somehow or other the focus on the earlier standard means that the data obtained are fudged, inaccurate, improper for testing against the new standard. I just don't see why that should be the case.
Well, I think the best evidence of the significance is that the state, in fact, did begin to collect a different level of data based upon the new standard in August of 2010. So they realized that they needed to change what they were monitoring in order for it to be meaningful and to be adequate quality. And yet we've got all this data from before August of 2010 that's being measured at the old standard. And the record suggests, at least comments we made, that that data is jeopardized as a result. And finally, I'd like to refer the court also to page 17 of the brief, where we noted the data collection for the purposes of comparison for the NAAQS requires more stringent requirements. Of course, the context here is we were very close in terms of attainment or unclassifiable. We were very close. And so all of these errors, as you begin to aggregate them, are very significant because we're in the margin of error. The major source of SO2, as is reflected in the record, had said that it was going to be mothballed. And so in that larger context, all these factors did not lead EPA to make Yellowstone County unclassifiable, which was the right outcome, and their decision, because of failure to follow their own handbook, is arbitrary and capricious.
Okay. Thank you very much.
The meteorological data that we refer to is in the record at Joint Appendix 661 to 670. It's, in fact, DTE's presentation. DTE is the owner of the Monroe Power Plant. And in their presentation, they are trying to explain why in 2009, when the U.S. steel plant was shut down due to economic concerns, that there were still violations at the monitor. And the conclusion that DTE's own engineer came to was that the meteorological consequences of their emissions had impacts at the Southwest High School monitor. I think there's a slippery slope problem here. If we accept EPA's interpretation of 107D, they can presumably set a boundary around a single source and wait until later for the rest of the sources to be brought into the non-attainment designation. They're not restricted by jurisdictional boundaries. In fact, in this case, on the record, the Wayne County boundary is not a jurisdictional-based boundary. They use roadways to determine the boundary around the non-attainment area. So if you allow EPA to set an area around a single source and leave out all the rest of the sources, they're choosing the winners and losers. They're choosing those that are required to reduce emissions to help area meet attainment.
I understand what you're saying. I guess I'm still not sure why two things. EPA's apparent uncertainty about Monroe County doesn't justify their delay of that decision. And second, that if I understand correctly, then you should refute this proposition. Okay, you will have a say in EPA's decision on whether to include Monroe County precisely on the basis that the power plant there causes exceedances in Wayne County.
EPA's determination of the area contributing to Wayne County in Monroe is not a separate designation. It's part of the non-attainment boundary for Wayne County. So, and even if we take the proposition that EPA has the authority to separate the designation in a later time period, that also imposes a burden on those that are within the initial designation. Our SIP obligations...
I see that as to your standing claim. I don't see it as to the finality issue. At least it seems to be it's more complicated as to the finality issue.
Well, EPA, if they're allowed to separate those designations by a matter of years, which is what they're asking this court to bless, means that the obligations for U.S. Steel will be in stone, in a SIP, and required well before they complete any analysis on the Monroe Power Plant. And by doing so, U.S. Steel will be required to reduce emissions to compensate for the emissions for the Monroe Power Plant to the extent they're contributing.
How long does a state implementation plan, what is the time period for a state implementation plan?
The obligation is that we have to meet the standard within 5 years from the date of designation.
Is the plan itself usually a five-year plan, or is it revisited and amended annually based on progress, intervening circumstances?
The SIP does have opportunities for it to be reevaluated periodically, but not within the five-year period.
Not within?
No, my understanding is that it's a five-year obligation to meet the attainment standard mm-hmm. based on the SIP. If you, at the end of that five-year period you haven't met attainment, there's an obligation to do more.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted.